Welcome to The Bridge, a weekly magazine show featuring local and regional stories. I'm Kathleen Morgane, your host. For decades, the tiny town of Riderwood, Washington was a peaceful, out-of-the-way community for seniors 55 and older. But several years ago, a legal battle began brewing between those who wanted Riderwood to become an all-ages community and those who wanted things to remain as they were.
Our attorneys pointed out, and even the judge pointed out, that a settlement would be the best method all the way around.
The fight dragged on for over 5 years. Some who initiated the lawsuit died before it was settled. Correspondent Tom Bonzi tells how the fight began and ended. Also on the show, the city of Seaside, Oregon is planning for its future and involving as many people as possible in the process. The first two of six public meetings were held last night. We'll hear about the citizens' top concerns, how they're being addressed. That's coming up in about 5 minutes. NPR News headlines are next. The time is 9:01. You're listening to The Bridge here on Coast Community Radio. I'm Kathleen Morgane. Oregon's Clatsop County recently concluded a series of community conversations about the directions citizens want the county to go in the next decades. Citizens weighed in on the economy and jobs, arts, culture and history, education and learning, public health and safety, community development, and the environment, natural resources, and recreation. Well, now the City of Seaside is seeking community input in a similar process called the City of Seaside 2034 Visioning. The initial meetings took place yesterday, and here in the studio to bring us the latest are Esther Moberg, Library Director for the City of Seaside, and Jay Barber, Seaside City Councilor. Good morning, Esther and Jay.
Good morning.
Well, first bring us up to with the to date about the visioning process so far.
So far, we have done a couple community sessions, like you'd mentioned. We've also done some surveys. We did a survey for visitors to the community. We also did a community survey for those who live and work in Seaside. And then we also did two surveys, one for teens and one for children. And we also did a teen summit at the high school. We had about 50 teens in attendance there, and that was really well received.
And now, why did the city initiate the project? And maybe, Jay, you want to take this one?
Well, this happened about 10 years ago, a first effort of this to include people not only living in Seaside, but people who have homes there and visitors. And we really felt like that was incomplete. We got a lot done. Out of that process came the skate park, the expansion of the Broadway field and park, and a number of other things that came out of that. But you know, envisioning the future to 2034, I don't think I'm going to be around then. And we really focused it on the younger people in our community to talk about what do they envision for the future of Seaside. And we've gotten some amazing input from them.
Well, that was one thing I was thinking about in that in the initial survey process, and I'll probably ask you about that in a second, you asked for input from youth. Specifically,
yes.
And from people who don't even live here, from out-of-towners.
Exactly. Even down to the middle school level, wasn't it?
Actually, to grade school. We actually even went to the Heights, and they actually had the children fill out our online survey for us. And we had some great responses. The kids really thought hard about what they wanted to see in Seaside. They were great at trying to vision what it would be like then.
Yeah. Did you hear anything that you didn't expect to hear?
You know, there were some really surprising things. I was surprised at the Teen Summit how many of the teens were focused on business diversity in our community. That was not something I really expected the teens to be aware of. They really wanted to see more opportunities for four-year education in our community in Clatsop County. For the children as well, they really were focused on Seaside just being, in some ways, staying the same as far as a small town feel, but they also knew the importance of jobs in the community. So for that younger age to be aware of that was really exciting.
My favorite was the desire for a roller coaster that all the high school and middle school kids could ride free. I love that idea.
Every Saturday, I think.
Saturday.
And it would be right next to the new school they envisioned. A lot of the kids and teens do envision a new school in the community that's outside of the tsunami zone. And they do see the importance of having a safe school that they can be at, but also having that level of, the new buildings and everything. That was throughout, which wasn't too surprising given our previous going out to get a new school.
The city council really has supported this concept, and each one of the counselors is facilitating an interest group to bring people from the community who have an interest, particularly like in public safety. I'm chairing or facilitating the one on the environment. And in this way, we get a broad basis of input from people in the community and people that have homes or visiting in the community. So that to me, mm-hmm. will give us a final look at really what is the vision for 2034.
Mm-hmm. And I'm personally new to the visioning process, and one thing that was kind of exciting for me was that yesterday a lot of people came with a list of things they wanted done. You know, one gentleman had 16 items he wanted specifically done in Seaside to improve the infrastructure. But then also there was a lot of discussion in that same meeting, which was the one on public safety and parks and rec, about kind of pulling ourselves up by our bootstraps and doing it as a community-wide effort. They did a lot of talk about funding, which, you know, in the visioning process, it's more about the dreaming big. And then when we get to strategic planning, you start talking about funding and everything and see where the shakedown comes of what's prioritized. But people were really excited, I think, about the process.
Now, you had the first of these meetings took place yesterday.
Yes.
And have you had any time to process people's reactions and comments?
Very briefly. Yeah. We have had, you know, just kind of summarize both of the, it was actually a combination of three because we had two topics at the one meeting, public safety and parks and rec, and then in the evening we had a business development meeting. So we do have, you know, our notes with us. Mm-hmm. Like I mentioned, the first meeting was kind of primarily about, they mentioned safety at the parks. A lot of people loved the park system we already had, but would like to see an increase in connections between those parks. So, you know, a safer bike trail that connects around throughout the city, and then also maybe some buffers. Yeah, so.
You know, it's very specific kinds of information that we're getting from those who attend those meetings. Our big challenge is going to be taking all of that input from six meetings and coming up with a visioning plan. And I think it'll happen. I think those dominant ideas will float to the top, and we'll be able to come up with a very comprehensive vision for 2034. We're very pleased with the input we're getting.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like overall people are pretty happy with the state of parks and recreation in Seaside. What were you hearing about public safety?
So there is, of course, a very big concern about tsunamis. And, you know, one thing that the city always is trying to do is educate people on what's currently in place. I think we had some people there that were fairly new to the city yesterday, and they were not aware of what was currently being done as far as safety precautions. But, you know, there are some very big concerns. You know, what happens if there is an incredibly large catastrophic event and the entire city's gone? How do we rebuild? How do we restructure? So people do have a lot of concern regarding that and what we can do to help with that. Obviously, with the Japanese tsunami event, you can see, you know, sometimes you think what you have in place is adequate and then it isn't. So that is a very huge topic for our town, of course. Yeah.
And the business and the economy.
Well, I think the real interest is to see a diversification of business in the community. We're a tourist-based economy, of course, in Seaside, but I think the sense that we got from the high school students particularly is that, interestingly, they want to see more diversity in the business, more than just tourist-focused. So, yeah, we got great feedback in terms of diversification of business.
Mm-hmm. Now, more about the turnout of people who came. Periodically, visioning-type format meetings are held. People come, they say what they would like to see, and then there's a feeling of letdown when there really isn't a plan of implementation.
And part of this process, what we want to create at the end is something called a living document. So once we've created this vision plan at the end, it's changeable. It's not like we've created this, we set it aside, city council moves on, check this off our list, we're done. We plan that they will take this, you know, what they've learned from this, all the list of priorities, they'll take this into their strategic planning, we'll take this into the future with us regarding, you know, what people in the community really want to see. So we don't expect this to stay as on the shelf once we're done.
Now, you've just started these series of meetings.
Yes.
Now, what topics are you going to be bringing up next?
Well, the environmental group is meeting on the 19th of June, And I think the others, Arts and Culture, is coming up.
On June 10th, yes. And that'll be at the library at 5:30. It's in Seaside. And then June 2nd will be Family Features, and we don't have where that will be held yet, but we do have on the City of Seaside's Vision website. We update it daily when we have the meetings and times and places. So all of it's located on the City of Seaside's website if people want further information.
Yeah. Environment, we're hoping to meet at the library. I don't think we've confirmed that yet.
But you should do something about
we'll work
talk.
That out.
Okay. Was there anything in the how representative was the survey as far as response to the population? And did anything unusual pop up in that you didn't expect?
Yeah. So we had over 500 responses. It was closer to 550 responses to all four of our surveys. For the visitor survey, the main bulk of people that responded were actually from Washington State, which was kind of surprising. Mm-hmm. And then the second majority was Portland, of course. For the community, it was evenly dispersed around Seaside area and then, of course, outside the community. So it felt like we really got a good snapshot of people responding. So that was great. Yeah. And, you know, we had about 92 teens respond. We had over 100 visitors respond and over 200 of the community responded. And then 92 children as well.
So. Were there overwhelming differences between out-of-towners and full-time residents in their concerns?
Yeah, you know, we had the top six responses that we pulled these topics from, but every survey ranked them differently. So, of course, visitors, it was more about relaxation on the coast, and locals, it was more about we want more things specifically for the local community versus tourist-oriented. So there was a very, very different as far as what was the main priorities. I think it was for the public, for the community, parks and outdoor recreation ranked high, and public safety was one of the highest. Where visitors, it was more about family features and maybe, you know, seeing more restaurant diversity.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, to get that kind of response, really, it was phenomenal. In my business outside of city council, that really is statistically reliable information when you get that level of response. So it really did give us a clear indication of where the community wants to move into the future. And that really surprised me. I didn't expect to see that level of response.
Mm-hmm. Well, to wrap up, the survey part was really successful, and now the actual visioning sessions are underway. Mm-hmm. And when is the next session taking place?
So that'll be June 2nd. And I'm sorry, we don't have location and time yet, but we'll post that on the website soon.
And that is the City of Seaside website.
Yes.
Okay, well, Esther and Jay, thank you so much for coming this morning to talk about the Seaside visioning process.
Thank you.
Now we turn to a small town in Washington where advanced planning was not part of the process. When you approach your golden years, who doesn't look forward to peace and quiet surrounded by a supportive community? That desire led retirees to relocate to a tiny town deep in the woods of Southwest Washington. Riderwood bills itself as the nation's first seniors-only retirement village. But the tranquility that lured people there went missing during a long and divisive lawsuit. The case questioned whether this 400 or so strong community could be so exclusive. It came replete with allegations of shunning, death threats, uncollected garbage, and the tossing of a headless rabbit. Correspondent Tom Bonzi reports on the relief that has followed a settlement.
Riderwood started as a timber company town. When the loggers pulled out in the early 1950s, an enterprising developer converted the entire six-block-by-six-block village into a retirement haven. Now, Riderwood could serve as a social science petri dish to study bitterness, division, and healing. The laughter comes from the morning coffee crowd gathered at the town's volunteer-run cafe, a positive sign, say B. McKim and Cheryl Pierce.
It's pretty much back to good, like this town should be.
And it's happily over. We went through 5 years of hell.
What Pierce refers to is a recently settled federal lawsuit. It challenged the essence of Riderwood, that only retirees aged 55 or older can buy homes there. McKim and Pierce wanted to maintain the status quo. Resident Chris Wigner agrees and still doesn't understand how this turned into a costly lawsuit.
Why?
Why? Why move to a nice, quiet, beautiful place and then want to change it?
But 54 townspeople did want to change it and signed on to the age discrimination lawsuit. It was around the height of the housing crisis, and some of the plaintiffs wanted to be able to sell their Riderwood home to whomever they wanted. For others, like Gloria Leach and her husband, it was more about standing up to perceived shortcomings by the Homeowners Association, which enforces the 55 and older bylaw.
All I wanted was truth, but it did go longer than what we thought. A couple times we thought about dropping out, very expensive.
And divisive. The lawsuit pitted neighbor against neighbor. Mountains of court documents detail grandmas and grandpas behaving badly. There's alleged harassment, retaliation, intimidation, tire slashing, nasty emails, and hurled insults. The challengers claim they were made unwelcome at church and the community cafe.
We were shunned, and I could understand that they were very disappointed in the actions that we were taking.
The litigation lasted so long that some of those who challenged the age restriction died before it was resolved. Leach is just glad it's finally over.
We have some people that are very hostile and bitter and carrying on, and I keep reminding them that life is too short for this. Just get, you know. My favorite saying is, let go, let God.
On the other side, resident Chris Wigner says she did her best to behave honorably. In her assessment, it's going to take a long time to get over this.
It was a dumb thing, but people get into these fixed ideas, and here you are, you're spending the last years of your life and health, the last years of your money on what? Stupidity.
The Riderwood Homeowners Association has a relatively new leader who's trying to play the role of peacemaker. Denny Knight says the settlement reached this spring preserves the town's 55 and older bylaw. Riderwood's insurance company paid off some of the debts accumulated during the litigation on both sides.
Our attorneys pointed out, and even the judge pointed out, that a settlement would be the best method all the way around. Nobody's 100% happy, but the winner is the town. We can put this behind us.
The more than 5 years of arguing changed no policies to speak of. The little village at the end of the highway can go on proclaiming itself as the nation's original seniors-only retirement community. An unusually large number of Riderwood houses are now for sale. The majority of those listings belong to people who initiated the unsuccessful lawsuit. I'm Tom Bonsi in Riderwood, Washington.
You're listening to The Bridge here on Coast Community Radio, 91.9 KMUN Astoria and 89.5 KTCB Tillamook. I'm Kathleen Morgane. Still ahead, people have long collaborated in groups to pursue interests and develop projects. Project teams are common in large companies, but independent collaborators are joining in what is becoming known as the maker culture, where like-minded people share ideas, knowledge, skills, and tools for the development of a variety of projects, from electronics to metal and glass work.
Through the development of mass manufacturing, we've gotten away from the artisanal quality of making.
Hackerspaces are a sort of incubator for the maker culture. They're popping up in communities large and small. Today, we'll hear about the Rogue Hack Lab in Medford, Oregon. Leah Moriarty reports coming up just after this weather break. Here's the National Weather Service forecast for the Lower Columbia Coastal Region. Today, mostly cloudy. A 30% chance of showers this morning, partly to mostly cloudy this evening and overnight. Highs in the low 60s, lows 45 to 50. Gordon McCraw, meteorologist and director of Tillamook Emergency Management, says tomorrow things will warm up and dry out with partly to mostly sunny skies, highs into the low and mid-70s. Mostly sunny skies are also in the forecast for the weekend, though tomorrow will be the warmest day. The highs over the weekend will linger around 70 degrees. Monday and Tuesday still look dry and partly to mostly sunny, highs in the upper 60s. Lows remain in the low 50s through the beginning of next week. Makerspaces and hackerspaces are a growing phenomenon. They're places where everyday people gain access to the tools and the collaborative inspiration to combine art, engineering, and technology in new and innovative ways. Sometimes these projects become incubators for products and inventions with enormous potential. In Medford, the Rogue Hack Lab is a local expression of this global movement. Liam Moriarty has more.
For Micah Cardillo, the basic appeal of Rogue Hack Lab is pretty simple.
It's about coming together and tinkering together.
Cardillo is a board member at Rogue Hack Lab. He says having a cooperative facility with open access to a range of tools and technologies is incredibly useful.
But more importantly, it's about being able to run into people you would not normally run into.
Cardillo says that leads to a kind of collaborative cross-pollination that can reinvigorate a stalled project.
Sometimes you just run into a difficult spot and you don't know how to get past that. And when you start being in the same place with a lot of people with different skills, you can overcome those bumps and hurdles.
Kevin Connor is also on the board of Rogue Hack Lab. When he decided to build a 3D printer, he says there was a lot to learn.
I had to learn software, and I had to build the machine. I had to learn the plastic thermodynamics and how things are going to expand and shrink, robotics, firmware, and programming, microcontrollers, all that stuff.
And Connor says having access to collaborators with a wide range of skills helps a lot.
We have one guy who's an amazing electrical engineer, and we have a couple web programmers and, a dude who's made a 3D printer at least once, and all these different places, and we really love to just help each other.
Mark Hatch is CEO of TechShop, a chain of makerspaces on the West Coast and elsewhere. He's also author of The Maker Movement Manifesto. He says the sort of creative energy being fostered at Rogue Hack Lab is one of the defining characteristics of maker culture. Underlying it all, Hatch says, is a basic human need to create beautiful and useful things with our hands.
Through the development of mass manufacturing, we've gotten away from the artisanal quality of making.
Now, he says, not only are people reawakening to that need, but new technology is opening doors to a kind of artisanal manufacturing, fashioning industrial goods in small batches from local materials for local sale.
The tools of the Industrial Revolution are now being tied into computers, making it easier to produce high-quality products in lower volume at competitive prices, and making it easier for people to actually engage in and create fairly sophisticated projects and products on their own.
Hatch says this democratization of industrial production has far-reaching economic and social implications. He points to Patrick Buckley, the founder of the San Francisco-based firm Dodo Case, which makes covers for iPads and other electronics. He says Buckley came into the tech shop, took a few classes, developed a prototype, and within several months had orders for nearly $1 million worth of goods.
We've never operated in an environment where you could learn the skills inside of 2 weeks that could create a multi-million dollar company within a six-month span, but we are today.
Micah Cardillo says the members at Rogue Hack Lab have deliberately adopted a flexible format to foster that kind of creative exploration and innovation.
Amazing things happen when you don't put too much structure on where there doesn't need to be structure, especially if you have a lot of intergenerational mentoring going on between people with different skills and different interests.
By creating an open space to enable tinkering, the folks at Rogue Hack Lab hope to inspire community participation in shaping new ways of living in Southern Oregon. I'm Liam Moriarty reporting.
That's all the time we have for today's show. The Bridge airs weekly, Thursday mornings at 9. If you join the show late, you can listen to a podcast of the show from our website at coastradio.org. Just click the program box on the homepage. We welcome your comments on the show. Call us at 503-325-0010 or email to news1, that's NEWS, then the numeral 1, at KMUN.org. I'm Kathleen Morgane saying thank you for listening today, and listen in again next Thursday for the next edition of The Bridge. The Bridge is a production of Coast Community Radio.